Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Continuing with the section of the book on the Four Noble Truths, this is chapter 27, the First Noble Truth. The First Noble Truth, with its three aspects, is there is suffering, dukkha. Dukkha should be understood, dukkha has been understood. This is a very skillful teaching because it's expressed in a simple formula which is easy to remember. And it also applies to everything that you can possibly experience or do or think concerning the past, the present, or the future. Suffering, or dukkha, is the common bond we all share. Everybody everywhere suffers. Human beings suffered in the past, in ancient India. They suffer in modern Britain. And in the future, human beings will also suffer. What do we have in common with Queen Elizabeth? We suffer. With a tramp in Charing Cross, what do we have in common? Suffering. It includes all levels, from the most privileged human beings to the most desperate and underprivileged ones, and all ranges in between. Everybody everywhere suffers. It's a bond we have with each other, something we all understand. When we talk about our human suffering, it brings out our compassionate tendencies. But when we talk about our opinions, about what I think and what you think about politics and religion, then we can get into wars. I remember seeing a film in London about 10 years ago. It tried to portray Russian people as human beings by showing Russian women with babies and Russian men taking their children out for picnics. At the time, this presentation of the Russian people was unusual because most of the propaganda of the West made them out to be titanic monsters or cold-hearted reptilian people. And so you never thought of them as human beings. If you want to kill people, you have to make them out to be that way. You cannot very well kill somebody if you realize they suffer the way you do. You have to think that they are cold-hearted, immoral, worthless, and bad, and that it's better to get rid of them. You have to think that they are evil, and that it's good to get rid of evil. With this attitude, you might feel justified in bombing and machine-gunning them. If you keep in mind our common bond of suffering, that makes you quite incapable of doing those things. The First Noble Truth is not a dismal metaphysical statement that everything is suffering. Notice that there's a difference between a metaphysical doctrine in which you are making a statement about the absolute and a noble truth, which is a reflection. A noble truth, which is a truth to reflect upon. It's not an absolute. It's not the absolute. This is where Western people get very confused, because they interpret this noble truth as a kind of metaphysical truth of Buddhism, but it was never meant to be that. You can see that the First Noble Truth is not an absolute statement because of the Fourth Noble Truth, which is the way of non-suffering. You cannot have absolute suffering and then have a way out of it, can you? That doesn't make sense. Yet some people will pick up on the First Noble Truth and say that the Buddha taught that everything is suffering. The Pali word dukkha means incapable of satisfying or not able to bear or withstand anything. Always changing, incapable of truly fulfilling us or making us happy. The sensual world is like that, a vibration in nature. It would, in fact, be terrible if we did find satisfaction in the sensory world, because then we wouldn't search beyond it. We'd just be bound to it. However, as we awaken to this dukkha, we begin to find the way out so that we're no longer constantly trapped in sensory consciousness. It's important to reflect upon the phrasing of the First Noble Truth. It's phrased in a very clear way. There is suffering, rather than I suffer. Psychologically, that reflection is a much more skillful way to put it. We tend to interpret our suffering as, I'm really suffering, I suffer a lot, and I don't want to suffer. This is the way our thinking mind is conditioned. I am suffering, quote unquote, always conveys the sense of, I am somebody who is suffering a lot. This suffering is mine. I've had a lot of suffering in my life. Then the whole process, the association with oneself and one's memory, takes off. You remember what happened when you were a baby, and so on. But note, we're not saying that there is someone who has suffering. It's not personal suffering anymore when we see it as there is suffering. It's not, oh, poor me, why do I have to suffer so much? What did I do to deserve this? Why do I have to get old? Why do I have to have sorrow, pain, grief, and despair? It's not fair. I don't want it. I only want happiness and security. This kind of thinking comes from ignorance, which complicates everything and results in personality problems. To let go of suffering, we have to admit it into consciousness. But the admission in Buddhist meditation is not from a position of, I am suffering, but rather, there is the presence of suffering. Because we're not trying to identify with the problem, but simply acknowledging that there is one. It's unskillful to think in terms of, I'm an angry person. I get angry so easily. How do I get rid of it? This triggers off all the underlying assumptions of a self, and it's very hard to get any perspective on that. It becomes very confused because the sense of my problems or my thoughts takes us very easily to suppression or to making judgments about them and criticizing ourselves. We tend to grasp and identify rather than to observe, witness, and understand things as they are. When you're just admitting that there is this feeling of confusion, that there is this greed or anger, then there is an honest reflection on the way it is, and you've taken out all the underlying assumptions, or at least undermined them. So don't grasp these things as personal faults, but keep contemplating these conditions as impermanent, unsatisfactory, and not self. Keep reflecting, seeing them as they are. The tendency is to view life from the sense that these are my problems, and that one is being very honest and forthright in admitting this. Then our life tends to reaffirm that because we keep operating from that wrong assumption. But that very viewpoint is impermanent, unsatisfactory, and not self. There is suffering, quote unquote, is a very clear, precise acknowledgement that at this time there is some feeling of unhappiness. It can range from anguish and despair to mild irritation. Dukkha does not necessarily mean severe suffering. You do not have to be brutalized by life. You do not have to have come from Auschwitz or Belsen to say that there is suffering. Even Queen Elizabeth could say, there is suffering. I'm sure she has moments of great anguish and despair, or at least moments of irritation. The sensory world is a sensitive experience. It means you're always being exposed to pleasure and pain, and the dualism of samsara. It's like being in something that's very vulnerable and picking up everything that happens to come in contact with these bodies and their senses. That is the way it is. That's the result of birth. Suffering is something we usually do not want to know. We just want to get rid of it. As soon as there's any inconvenience or annoyance, the tendency of an unawakened human being is to get rid of it or suppress it. One can see why modern society is so caught up in seeking pleasures and delights in what is new, exciting, or romantic. We tend to emphasize the beauties and pleasures of youth, whilst the ugly side of life, old age, sickness, death, boredom, despair, and depression, is pushed aside. When we find ourselves with something that we do not like, we try to get away from it to something that we do like. If we feel boredom, we go to something interesting. If we feel frightened, we try to find safety. This is a perfectly natural thing to do. We're associated with that pleasure-pain principle of being attracted and repelled. So if the mind is not full and receptive, then it is selective. It selects what it likes and tries to suppress what it does not like. Much of our experience has to be suppressed because a lot of what we're inevitably involved with is unpleasant in some way. If anything unpleasant arises, we say, run away. If anyone gets in our way, we say, kill him. This tendency is often apparent in what our governments do. Frightening, isn't it? When you think of the kind of people who run our countries, because they're still very ignorant and unenlightened, but that's the way it is. The ignorant mind thinks of extermination. Here's a mosquito, kill it. These ants are taking over the room, spray them with ant killer. There's even a company in Britain called Rentokil that specializes in killing pests. However you want to interpret the word pests. That's why we have such laws as, I will refrain from intentionally killing. Because our instinctual nature is to kill. If it's in the way, kill it. You can see this in the animal kingdom. We are quite predatory creatures ourselves. We think we are civilized, but we have a really bloody history, literally. It's just filled with endless slaughters and justification for all kinds of iniquities against other human beings, not to mention animals. And it's all because of this basic ignorance, this unreflecting human mind that tells us to annihilate what's in our way. However, with reflection, we're changing that. We're transcending that basic instinctual animal pattern. We're not just being law-abiding puppets of society, afraid to kill because we're afraid of being punished. Now we're really taking on responsibility. We respect the lives of other creatures, even the lives of insects and creatures we do not like. Nobody is ever going to like mosquitoes or ants, but we can reflect on the fact that they have a right to live. That's a reflection of the mind. It's not just a reaction. Where's the insecticide spray? I also don't like to see ants crawling over my floor. My first reaction is, where's the insecticide spray? But then the reflective mind shows me that even though these creatures are annoying me, and I would rather they went away, they have a right to exist. That is a reflection of the human mind. The same applies to unpleasant mind states. So when you're experiencing anger, rather than saying, oh, here I go, angry again, we reflect. There is anger. Just like with fear. If you start seeing it as my mother's fear, or my father's fear, or the dog's fear, or my fear, then it all becomes a sticky web of different creatures related in some ways, unrelated in others. And it becomes difficult to have any real understanding. And yet, the fear in this being and the fear in that mangy cur is the same thing. There is fear. It's just that. The fear that I have experienced is no different from the fear that others have. So this is where we have compassion, even for mangy old dogs. We understand that fear is as horrible for mangy dogs as it is for us. When a dog is kicked with a heavy boot and you're kicked with a heavy boot, that feeling of pain is the same. Pain is just pain. Cold is just cold. Anger is just anger. It's not mine, but rather, there is pain. This is a skillful use of thinking that helps us to see things more clearly, rather than reinforcing the personal view. Then, as a result of recognizing the state of suffering, that there is suffering, the second insight of this first noble truth comes. It should be understood. This suffering is to be investigated. I encourage you to try to understand dukkha, to really look at, stand under, and accept your suffering. Try to understand it when you're feeling physical pain or despair and anguish or hatred and aversion, whatever form it takes, whatever quality it has, whether it's extreme or slight. This teaching doesn't mean that to get enlightened you have to be utterly and totally miserable. You don't have to have everything taken away from you or be tortured on the rack. It means being able to look at suffering, even if it is just mild feeling of discontent, and understand it. It's easy to find a scapegoat for our problems. If my mother had really loved me, or if everyone around me had been truly wise and fully dedicated towards providing a perfect environment for me, then I would not have the emotional problems I have now. This is really silly. Yet that's how some people actually look at the world, thinking that they are confused and miserable because they didn't get a fair deal. But with this formula of the first noble truth, even if we have had a pretty miserable life, what we're looking at is not that suffering. What we are looking at is not that suffering, that suffering which comes from out there, but what we create in our own minds around it. This is an awakening in a person, an awakening to the truth of suffering, and it's a noble truth because it's It's no longer blaming the suffering that we are experiencing onto others. Thus, the Buddhist approach is quite unique with respect to other religions, because the emphasis is on the way out of suffering through wisdom, freedom from all delusion, rather than the attainment of some blissful state or union with the ultimate. Now, I'm not saying that others are never the source of our frustration and irritation, but what we're pointing at with this teaching is our own reaction to life. If somebody is being nasty to you, or deliberately and malevolently trying to cause you to suffer, and you think it is that person who is making you suffer, you still have not understood this first noble truth. Even if he's pulling out your fingernails or doing other terrible things to you, as long as you think that you're suffering because of that person, you've not understood this first noble truth. To understand suffering is to see clearly that it is our reaction to the person pulling out our fingernails, "I hate you," that is suffering. The actual pulling out of one's fingernails is painful, but the suffering involves, "I hate you," and "How can you do this to me?" and "I'll never forgive you." However, don't wait for somebody to pull out your fingernails in order to practice with the first noble truth. Good idea. Try it with little things, like somebody being insensitive or rude or ignoring you. If you're suffering because that person has slighted you or offended you in some way, you can work with that. There are many times in daily life when we can be offended or upset. We can feel annoyed or irritated just by the way somebody walks or looks. At least I can. Sometimes you can notice yourself feeling aversion just because of the way somebody walks or because they don't do something that they should. One can get very upset and angry about things like that. The person has not really harmed you or done anything to you, like pulling out your fingernails, but still you suffer. If you cannot look at suffering in these simple cases, you'll never be able to be so heroic as to do it, if ever somebody does actually pull out your fingernails. We work with the little dissatisfactions in the ordinariness of life. We look at the way we can be hurt and offended or annoyed and irritated by the neighbours, or by the people we live with, by the government, by the way things are, or by ourselves. We know that this suffering should be understood. We practice by really looking at suffering as an object and understanding this is suffering. So we have the insightful understanding of suffering. We can investigate. Where has this hedonistic seeking of pleasure as an end in itself brought us? It has continued now for several decades, but is humanity any happier as a result? It seems that nowadays we've been given the right and freedom to do anything that we like, with drugs, sex, travel and so on. Anything goes. Anything is allowed. Nothing is forbidden. You have to do something really obscene, really violent, before you'll be ostracized. But has being able to follow our impulses made us any happier, or more relaxed and contented? In fact, it's tended to make us very selfish. We don't think about how our actions might affect others. We tend to think only about ourselves, me and my happiness, my freedom and my rights. So I become a terrible nuisance and a source of great frustration, annoyance and misery for the people around me. If I think I can do anything I want or say anything I feel like saying, even at the expense of others, then I'm a person who is nothing but a nuisance to society. When the sense of what I want and what I think I should and should not be arises, and we wish to delight in all the pleasures of life, we inevitably get upset because life seems so hopeless and everything seems to go wrong. We just get whirled about by life, just running around in states of fear and desire. And even when we get everything that we want, we'll still think that there is something missing, something still incomplete. So even when life is at its best, there is still this sense of suffering, something still to be done. Some kind of doubt or fear haunting us. For example, I've always liked beautiful scenery. Once during a retreat that I led in Switzerland, I was taken to some beautiful mountains and noticed that there was always a sense of anguish in my mind because there was so much beauty, a continual flow of beautiful sights. I had the feeling of wanting to hold on to everything, that I had to keep alert all the time in order to consume everything with my eyes. It was really wearing me out. Now, that was dukkha, wasn't it? I find that if I do things heedlessly, even something quite harmless, like looking at beautiful mountains. If I'm just reaching out and trying to hold on to something, it always brings an unpleasant feeling. How can you hold on to the Jungfrau and the Eigen? The best you can do is to take a picture of it, trying to capture everything on a piece of paper. That's dukkha. If you want to hold on to something that is beautiful, because you don't want to be separated from it, that is suffering. Having to be in situations you don't like is also suffering. For example, I never liked riding on the underground in London. I complain about it. I don't want to go on the underground with those awful posters and the dingy underground stations. I don't want to be packed into those little trains under the ground. I found it a totally unpleasant experience. But I'd listened to this complaining, moaning voice, the suffering of not wanting to be with something unpleasant. Then, having contemplated this, I stopped making anything of it, so that I could be with the unpleasant and unbeautiful without suffering about it. I realized that it's just that way, and it's all right. We needn't make problems, either about being in a dingy underground station or about looking at beautiful scenery. Things are as they are, so we can recognize and appreciate them in their changing forms without grasping. Grasping is wanting to hold on to something that we like, wanting to get rid of something that we don't like, or wanting to get something we don't have. We can also suffer a lot because of other people. I remember that in Thailand, I used to have quite negative thoughts about one of the monks. He'd do something, and I'd think, he shouldn't do that. Or he'd say something, he shouldn't say that. I'd carry this monk around in my mind, and then, even if I went to some other place, I'd think of that monk. The perception of him would arise, and the same reactions would come. Do you remember when he said this, and when he did that? And he shouldn't have said that, he shouldn't have done that. Having found a teacher like Ajahn Chah, I remember wanting him to be perfect. I'd think, oh, he's a marvelous teacher, marvelous. And then he might do something that would upset me, and I think, I don't want him to do anything that upsets me, because I like to think of him as being marvelous. That was like saying, Ajahn Chah, be marvelous for me all the time. Don't ever do anything that will put any kind of negative thought into my mind. So even when you find somebody whom you really respect and love, there's still the suffering of attachment. Inevitably, they will do or say something that you're not going to like or approve of, causing you some kind of doubt, and you'll suffer. At one time, several American monks came to Wat Bapong, our monastery in northeast Thailand. They were very critical, and it seemed that they only saw what was wrong with it. They didn't think Ajahn Chah was a very good teacher, and they didn't like the monastery. I felt a great anger and hatred arising because they were criticizing something that I loved. I felt indignant. Well, if you don't like it, get out of here. He's the finest teacher in the world, and if you can't see that, then just go. That kind of attachment. Being in love or being devoted is suffering, because if something or someone you love or like is criticized, you feel angry and indignant. Sometimes insight arises at the most unexpected times. This happened to me while living at Wat Bapong. Northeast Thailand is not the most beautiful or desirable place in the world, with its scrubby forests and flat plain. It also gets extremely hot during the hot season. We'd have to go out in the heat of the mid-afternoon before each of the observance days and sweep the leaves off the paths. There were vast areas to sweep. We would spend the whole afternoon in the hot sun, sweating and sweeping the leaves into piles with crude brooms. This was one of our duties. I didn't like doing this. I think, I don't want to do this. I didn't come here to sweep leaves off the ground. I came here to get enlightened. And instead they have me sweeping leaves off the ground. Besides, it's hot and I have fair skin. I might get skin cancer from being out here in a hot climate. I was standing out there one afternoon feeling really miserable, thinking, what am I doing here? Why did I come here? Why am I staying here? There I stood with my long crude broom and absolutely no energy, feeling sorry for myself and hating everything. Then Ajahn Chah came up, smiled at me and said, Wat Bapong's a lot of suffering, isn't it? Smiled and walked away. So I thought, why did he say that? And actually, you know, It's not all that bad. He got me to contemplate, is sweeping the leaves really that unpleasant? No, it's not. It's a kind of neutral thing. You sweep the leaves and it's neither here nor there. Is sweating all that terrible? Is it really a miserable, humiliating experience? Is it really as bad as I'm pretending it is? No. Sweating is all right. It's a perfectly natural thing to be doing. And I don't have skin cancer, and the people at Wat Pa Pong are very nice. The teacher is a very kind, wise man. The monks have treated me very well. The lay people come and give me food to eat. And what am I complaining about? Reflecting upon the actual experience of being there, I thought, I'm all right. People respect me, and I'm treated well. I'm being taught by pleasant people in a very pleasant country. There's nothing really wrong with anything, except me. I'm making a problem out of it, because I don't want to sweat, and I don't want to sweep leaves. Then I had a very clear insight. I suddenly perceived something in me which was always complaining and criticizing, and which was preventing me from ever giving myself to anything, or offering myself to any situation. Another experience I learned from was the custom of washing the feet of the senior monks when they returned from the alms round. After they walked barefoot through the villages and rice paddies, their feet would be muddy. There were foot baths outside the dining hall. When Ajahn Chah would come, all the monks, maybe 20 or 30 of them, would rush out and wash Ajahn Chah's feet. When I first saw this, I thought, I'm not going to do that, not me. Then the next day, 30 monks rushed out as soon as Ajahn Chah appeared and washed his feet. I thought, what a stupid thing to be doing. 30 monks washing one man's feet. I'm not going to do that. The day after that, the reaction became even more violent. 30 monks rushed out and washed Ajahn Chah's feet, and that really angers me. Yeah, I'm fed up with this. That's the most stupid thing I've ever seen. 30 men going out to wash one man's feet. He probably thinks he deserves it, you know. It's really building up his ego. He's probably got an enormous ego, having so many people wash his feet every day. I'll never do that. I was beginning to build up a strong reaction, an overreaction. I would sit there really feeling miserable and angry. I'd look at the monks and I'd think, they all look stupid to me. I don't know what I'm doing here. But then I started listening and I thought, this is really an unpleasant frame of mind to be in. Is it anything to get upset about? They haven't made me do it. It's all right. There's nothing wrong with 30 men washing one man's feet. It's not immoral or bad behavior, and maybe they enjoy it. Maybe they want to do it. Maybe it's all right to do that. Maybe I should do it. So the next morning, 31 monks ran out and washed Ajahn Chah's feet. There was no problem after that. It felt really good. That nasty thing in me had stopped. We can reflect upon these things that arouse indignation and anger in us. Is something really wrong with them? Or is it something we create dukkha about? Then we begin to understand the problems we create in our own lives and in the lives of the people around us. With mindfulness, we're willing to bear with the whole of life, with the excitement and the boredom, the hope and the despair, the pleasure and the pain, the fascination and the weariness, the beginning and the ending, the birth and the death. We're willing to accept the whole of it in the mind rather than absorb into just the pleasant and suppress the unpleasant. The process of insight is the going to dukkha, looking at dukkha, admitting dukkha, recognizing dukkha in all its forms. Then you're no longer just reacting in the habitual way of indulgence or suppression. And because of that, you can bear with suffering more. You can be more patient with it. These teachings are not outside our experience. They are, in fact, reflections of our actual experience. Not complicated intellectual issues. So really put effort into development rather than just getting stuck in a rut. How many times do you have to feel guilty about your abortion or the mistakes you've made in the past? Do you really have to spend all your time just regurgitating the things that have happened to you in your life and indulging in endless speculation and analysis? Some people make themselves into such complicated personalities. If you just indulge in your memories and views and opinions, then you'll always stay stuck in the world, never transcend it in any way. You can let go of this burden if you're willing to use the teaching skillfully. Tell yourself, I'm not going to get caught up in this anymore. I refuse to participate in this game. I'm not going to give in to this mood. Start putting yourself in the position of knowing. I know this is dukkha. There is dukkha. It's really important to make this resolution, to go where the suffering is and then abide with it. It's only by examining and confronting suffering in this way that one can hope to have the tremendous insight. This suffering has been understood. So these are the three aspects of the First Noble Truth. This is the formula that we must use and apply in reflection on our lives. Whenever you feel suffering, first make the recognition, there is suffering. Then it should be understood. And finally, it has been understood. This understanding of dukkha is the insight into the First Noble Truth. Well, once again, he. This talk was probably taken from the time when the Cold War was still on. So, at the beginning of the talk, talking about the demonization of Russians, it's a different world now. But if you remember that in that era, there was a lot of demonizing of the Soviet Union, and there was the arms race going. Vigorously forward to what they had the acronym MAD, Mutually Assured Destruction. And if you remember that era in the early 80s, there was a poster they made of the Gone with the Wind poster with Margaret Thatcher substituted for Scarlett O'Hara and Ronald Reagan substituted for Rhett Butler, Clark Gable. And the caption changed. He promised to take her to the end of the world, and she said she'd try to arrange it. So that was that era, and seeing how you can blame the other for being titanic monsters or cold-hearted reptilian people, and and also using that example from the simile of the saw about the having your fingernails pulled out, that this is a frequent theme and very much of significance in Buddhist practice, because as we can blame the Russians, or we can blame terrorists, or we can blame the government for our suffering, we can always blame that other person who's working with us in the kitchen, or that is the cause of our suffering. As he says, use the mild irritations of daily life. We don't have to wait until someone's pulling our fingernails out, but we can look at the things that are just minor offense, things that are offensive or upsetting that happen on a small scale, that example that the Buddha gives, if you were kidnapped by bandits and they were cutting your arms and legs off with a two-handled saw, if you gave rise to the feeling of aversion on account of that, then you would not be following his teaching. So that is a very demanding standard, but the Buddha is brilliant at having these kind of memorable images that he uses to illustrate his teachings, so that even when you think it was totally a little bit of hatred would be quite reasonable, quite understandable. And he said, even in a situation like that, it's not justifiable, that any kind of hatred is necessarily out of accord with Dhamma. It doesn't mean to say that you don't do anything. You could start talking and say, negotiate with your tormentors. And so that you don't have to be totally passive, but to give rise to hatred and blaming on account of that is necessarily to be out of whack with the teaching. When the most dangerous, one of the most dangerous incidents I've ever experienced as a monk was actually the day of I.B. Horner's funeral. Relative of mine, who was a famous Buddhist translator. She died in in the early 80s, and I went to her funeral at Golders Green Crematorium and was heading back to Chithurst on the train, and it was a Saturday afternoon, and crossing the open area in Waterloo Station, then I know there was a few football rowdies who were calling out and making calling names and such like. We didn't really bother me, or didn't really notice them that much, and headed for the train, and then got onto the train, and I found that to our surprise, that even though the train was quite crowded, there was a compartment that wasn't in first class that was empty. I thought, well, this is handy. So myself and the Anagarika got into the compartment. And then about eight of these football supporters, West Ham supporters, came piling in. First of all, it was just it was a no smoking compartment. This very large guy came in with a cigarette, took a hefty toke on it so it was burning nice and hot, and then flicked it into my face. And then swore at me in a very extremely aggressive and vulgar way. And then, so I thought, aha, this is going to be interesting. And then about another six of them piled into the compartment. And so that was a very dangerous situation. And who knows what was going to happen next. But the thing I did was, rather than get lost in sort of cowering or kind of reacting, that as soon as as they came piling in, and some of them started saying, "Well, who are you? Where are you? What are you doing?" And then I immediately focused on the ones who were talking and started a conversation. And as you know, you might have discerned by now, I can talk extensively and spontaneously. So I immediately, the ones who were asking questions or saying something, then I immediately locked onto them and screened out this kind of burly aggressive guy, and then started to relate to these fellows on a more of a person to person level. And it was clear that some of them were just looking for a fight, just wanted to beat me up. And that was just what they were looking for, an excuse. They're trying to get a reaction and just wanted to start thumping. But I had this intuitive sense that as long as you keep relating on a human level, you don't reject them or hate them or blame them or criticize them, but you relate more on a human-to-human level, then you're able to find a place where you can meet. And it was kind of interesting how that they started asking about, well, what are you anyway? What do you do? How do you live? So then we were having this dialogue, and they were saying, so what about sex then? And I said, well, they don't have any kind of sex. Well, you must have, come on, you know. I said, no, I guess I've been in robes for about 4 or 5 years by then. I said, yeah, I've been a monk for about 3 years now, I haven't had sex in all that time. Ah, oh, come on, you must do, you know. Whoa, it'd explode, if it was me. And they start sort of comparing notes with each other. And it turned into quite a kind of delightful conversation. The guy who'd flicked the cigarette in my face was sitting there kind of looking like very frustrated that his mates weren't playing along. But it was exactly as Lumpur puts in there, when you start to humanize the other and you relate person to person, then you can avoid that sense of conflict, and also to help the dukkha come to an end. You don't blame them, don't blame the other for causing you trouble. Or even as I'm talking about it, it never really occurred to me to dislike those guys. I was also fortunate that West Ham won that day, so they were in a jovial mood. If West Ham had lost, I think it would have been a bit different. But. And then we got to Guildford, they all piled off, they're all from Guildford, they all piled off the train and left the two of us sitting there. But it was quite a sweet encounter, really, and I had some quite fun. And by the time the guys were leaving, oh, well, good boy, see you, mate, sometime, yeah, you going to come to a match next weekend, I said, no, I don't think so. But it was quite cheerful and friendly. So that, that that sense of those kind of incidents stick in your mind. They're extreme, and the sort of big scale conflicts or issues. But it's important also just to notice those little irritations or things that you feel kind of not quite right about, or that something that upsets you or makes you anxious or irritates you. Just to see, oh, I'm blaming her, or I'm blaming him, or I'm blaming the way things are done. That's the issue or the problem. And to at that moment, that's the moment to catch it and say, no, it's not that. It's this. This is. The dukkha's not there, the dukkha's here. It's not from outside. It's what my mind is doing with it. So let's see. Then this incident of Lumpur Sumedho and sweeping leaves disappears in many, many Dhamma talks of his. It's obviously a very impactful moment, but it reflects that also in this how we tend to be a victim of our own thinking mind, and that the mind rationalizes and blames and says, it's the heat, it's the dust, it's the sweeping leaves. And also, particularly, as you're sweeping, the leaves are still coming off the trees. It's not like autumn here, where you just have like one season in the year where the leaves come down and they stay down. But in Thailand, they're falling off the trees all the time. So no matter how well you sweep the paths, and it's not too long before the leaves are on the paths again. So they never really get done. But being able to cut through that and to recognize, if it's only a problem because I make it a problem. If I don't call it a problem, it's not a problem. And which might seem a bit facile, but I think it's also very, very skillful. Like I often quote Harold Macmillan, who was Prime Minister of the UK back in the 50s, early 60s, and during one of the during the Suez crisis in the late 50s, he was interviewed by a reporter, and the reporter said, what's your, Mr. Prime Minister, may I ask you, what is your feeling about the problem in the Middle East and the occupation of the Suez Canal by the Egyptian forces and the crisis that's ensuing there? How do you feel that Britain ought to respond to the problem? And he said, oh, there isn't a problem. There's no problem there. And so the reporter, excuse me, Prime Minister, but there's severe tensions there. There's all kinds of military conflict. The British interests are highly threatened, and there's sort of the Arab and Israeli issues are all woven in this together. I can't understand how you could possibly say there isn't a problem. He said, well, to call it a problem presumes there's a solution. There is no solution, therefore it's not a problem. So you might think, well, come on, this is typical sort of political speak. But it's also quite skillful in that exactly that the way that Lumpur had with the broom, saying, if I call it a problem, it's a problem. If I don't call it a problem, it's not a problem. Or maybe you just rephrase it as an interesting difficulty, rather than my problem. And just the other day, I was having a conversation with one of the regulars who comes here on a Sunday, and was talking about particular issues in her family. And I said, well, yeah, if you call it a problem, you've got a problem with your son, then you have got a problem with your son. If you call it an interesting challenge, then it's like picking up a crossword and sort of working out a Sudoku or a crossword in the newspaper. It's like, yeah, it's a challenge, how to figure out to work with the different elements that are there. But it doesn't have to be something that's stressful or burdensome. Yes, there's some, intelligence and some creativity needs to be found to work the situation to a good solution. But it's to call it a problem, then you're intrinsically saying there's something wrong with it. But if you say it's an interesting challenge, then it reframes the way that that you hold it. Any questions, reflections, considerations?
How do we face evil, Arjun? Because in the world there is, now we can sort of, the difficulty for a lot of Buddhists is the fact that, you know, we can say, I'm a Buddhist, kick me, you know, but there is...
They do? I never met a Buddhist who said that.
No, it can sort of appear like that, but it can't, you know, inactivity sort of thing, because, you know, if you look to say the way the Aborigines are treated, the Tibetans, the Syrians, there is injustice in the world, injustice, you know. People do, through no fault of their own, suffer because of people's ignorance and violence, you know. So it's a difficult one for Buddhists, isn't it? How do we respond to that?
Well, it's important to know the evil inside yourself. Like, how do you meet the because to say there is evil out there, like with the demonizing the Russians, the Soviet Union, it was that all Russians were cast as sort of cold-hearted monsters. And as Lumpur was describing there, there was also this movement in the States, this institute called the Esalen Institute, right in the height of the Cold War. They started completely outside the government channels. They started creating meetings between Russian and American professionals, architects and doctors and such like, just to have them in contact with each other, to eat together, to go to the beach together, and just to create those bridges to humanize each other, because of course the Russians were, you know, people in the Soviet Union were being fed the same stories, you know, America is the evil monster, and just to humanize the contact. So they were doing that through the late 70s and early 80s, and at that time they were pretty much the only group that were involved in that effort, and it was quite a radical thing to do, and also had a very, very good impact. I went to, I used to teach at the Esalen Institute when I was living in the States, and one time they had a kind of, what would you call it, a sort of reunion meeting of many of the Russian guys who had been involved in helping to set those meetings up and coming to the States, or inviting American professionals to meet in Russia. So there's this extraordinary array of people that were there, who'd been the translator for Stalin and Hitler. He was Stalin's translator when Stalin and Hitler were negotiating things at the beginning of the Second World War. There was the guy who'd set up the Russian TV system, and, you know, a whole crowd of very interesting people. It was a very, very well lubricated meeting. You got fumes of vodka emanating from the dining room, so I had to keep a wide berth. But it was quite marvelous to see at that time, which was already the 90s, how so much of that had decompressed through that humanizing and refusing to call others evil, but in a sense touching into that human quality. So instead of in terms of, rather than confronting evil out there, it's important to look inside our own heart, that what are the things in here that we call evil, or that we want to reject, or that we look down on, and to really understand and acknowledge those things in us which are very destructive and selfish and poisonous, and to understand those and to know those, and then as we learn how to work with those qualities in ourselves, then we are able to learn how to work with those qualities as we meet them outside ourselves, because like Alexander Solzhenitsyn said that it would be very easy if we could just isolate evil and destroy it. But you know, unfortunately, there is the good and evil inhabit every human heart. So you'd have to divide every human heart down the middle, and to destroy all the evil in the world. And that's an incorrect quote, but it's something along those lines. So I feel that's important to recognize that. And you have in the Buddhist scriptures the dialogues between the Buddha and Mara, where the Mara comes along and is always trying to confuse or tempt or trick the Buddha. And then the Buddha always meets Mara or responds to Mara by saying, I know you, evil one. Yeah, I know you. He doesn't attack. He doesn't get defensive. He doesn't run away. He doesn't switch off. He just says, I know you. And so that recognizing that unwholesome quality in ourselves and acknowledging it and that refusing to go along with it is a skillful thing. So it also then in terms of how we relate to the external world, recognizing what is unwholesome, what's harmful, and refusing to go along with it, because you don't have the good guys. you look at any government, you don't have to even peer too far below the surface to see this. Our wonderful so-called free nations our governments do all kinds of things that are highly destructive and you could say immoral in many ways, but yet it's our lot. So they're recognizing what's wholesome, what's unwholesome, and then what's unwholesome to do what you can to restrain it from arising, or if it has arisen to help it to end, but not through aversion or negativity, but just through the skillful working with the conditions that we can. So that recognition of what's unwholesome, unskillful, acknowledging it, knowing it, and then seeking out skillful means to address that. That's the best we can do as human beings. And what those skillful means are, they're going to vary according to your situation or what your resources are or how you can express yourself or the effect that you can have. And that's up to our own creativity and our own potential. Okay. So tomorrow will be the last reading for a while, since I have a solo retreat time from Saturday onwards, and so Friday is the observance day. That's right. Today's Wednesday, right? Yeah. So Thursday will be the last reading for a while, and then probably start up again in March. That's, my solo retreat goes to end of February. So just one more of these for the next little while. Annamayaṁ dhammagatā sādhukaraṁ dadhamase sādhu, sādhu.